Hi, my name is Cecilia Vicuña. I'm a poet and artist from Chile. I do films, performance, I sing, I do so many things. And I am here because I am presenting my new book, published out of Kelsey Street Press here in Berkeley, called New Unselected Poetry, and presenting my exhibition about to happen at the Berkeley Art Museum.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I read that you began creating precarious works in the mid-60s as a way of hearing an ancient silence waiting to be heard. Talk about how you use your artistic process to give voice to narratives that might not otherwise be heard.
Well, you know, I was a young girl facing the Pacific Ocean, and one day I felt that the ocean was alive and aware. And I began listening in a new way from that moment forward. And I naturally extended that listening to everything around me, even the little debris thrown about in the beach. And I started to pick up things that were abandoned and disregarded. And that began teaching me and guiding me. And that's what I continued to do. So I first began picking up the little sticks and bones and feathers and arranging them as if they were a civilization, a different culture that would be erased by the high tide. And then that also led me to hearing the ancient songs, the ancient languages, all these extraordinary cultures. I'm indigenous myself, but I'm mixed blood. So I felt much closer to the ancient culture of Chile than to the European culture that had arrived only 500 years ago.
How old were you, I have to ask, when you started really paying attention to the ocean and to the debris and all of this, and the time that you were really coming into this awareness of maybe yourself as an artist?
I was just 17 years old. But I think teenagers and children often are so incredibly aware, and we don't pay attention to how aware they are. And so I can tell by my own writings of the time, like in the new book, I include a lot of the writings of the 60s that were censored pretty intensely in Chile. And they are such wild writings of free, erotic, sexual understanding that it's very hard for adults to imagine that a young teenager could have such a deep perception of herself.
You've mentioned that you're indigenous and also that you have roots in Chile. I understand that you've been in exile since the early 70s. Talk about how art has helped you to cope and find a level of empowerment for yourself and for those around you.
Well, yes, you know, Chile was an extraordinary native indigenous culture up until 1973. We had developed our own participatory democracy that was perhaps the most advanced in the world. Completely free, a free choice of socialism. And so it was just an expression of joy and really a magnificent experiment, a social experiment. And I was fully part of that. And when the military coup came, which was supported by the US government, and all that was destroyed, it was through the practice of my anticipatory memory. Somehow, something in me felt that all this magnificence that we were part of would be gone one day. So I gathered and I wrote and I picked up all kinds of writings and magazines and different expressions by different people. So my art was naturally a sort of carrier of a future memory, even when I was a teenager.
That's very powerful. Can you talk about some of the social and cultural issues that you hope that your art addresses?
Even in the 60s, we already knew that life on this planet was very badly threatened by overexploitation and abuse, by the culture of profit, the capitalist culture of only considering gain and not the survival of any kind of culture, species, language, and even resources. You know, so I began from early on devoting my activity to an environmental practice of a different order. And I found inspiration to do that in my own ancient culture. And for example, one of my first works was devoted to the ocean. The ocean was already polluted with oil. My art began in a place called Concon, which is one of the most ancient sacred sites of Chile. And an oil refinery was set exactly on top of the cemetery of the ancient cultures, you know, cultures going back 6,000 years. So that is a typical practice of capitalism, you know, to destroy the memory of the local people and convert them into slaves of the new culture of oil. And so that was happening with us, destroying the fisheries, destroying everything, even back then. So my art has always paid attention to what is being destroyed with the intent of bringing back a different way of relating to the earth.
And on that topic, or on a related note, I understand that you also took on the topic of Catholicism and kind of retelling the narrative about saints versus colonizers in the 70s. And I think when we're talking about indigenous culture, that's a really important point to touch on. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. You know, pre-Columbian America had some of the most extraordinary art expressions of any culture in the world, especially relating to textiles, extremely advanced, not only visually as imagery, but also technologically. And so even today, computers cannot recreate the many techniques that we had. And so this culture was destroyed to impose Catholicism, and the artists were enslaved to work for the Catholic Church in the production of saints. So very early on, in the year 1969, I began to create what I call santos al revés, meaning saints in reverse. So I used the technique of oil painting brought on by the Europeans in order to represent saints of the revolution. You know, people that had given their life for the liberation of Latin America, such as Fidel, Allende, Violeta Parra. And so these saints were horribly censored, and also angels of menstruation, for example. So these works were very feminist, and really they were very funny at the same time. So they were a huge hit before the coup, and after the coup they were censored completely.
Wow. One of the things you're doing here, in addition to your art exhibition, is promoting your book. And I understand that you have 22 poetry books that have already been published. And earlier today, you recorded yourself reading a piece for us. Can you tell us about this piece?
Yes, it's a poem that I wrote in the 60s, and it's called La Gitana Dormida, The Sleeping Gypsy. And it was inspired by a painting that is hanging at the MoMA by Henri Rousseau. And this painting represents a lion that is watching over a sleeping woman. And this woman looks very much like an indigenous dark-skinned woman, and she's dreaming. So I read that poem thinking of dedicating it to the dreamers that are now persecuted by the U.S. government and denied their right to be in the U.S. after having grown and been educated in the U.S. and feeling really Americans with the right to dream. And I think the destruction of dreams and the ability to dream together a different kind of society is one of the most destructive things that this current government is doing.
And with that, let's take a quick pause right here and we'll play this poem for our listeners.
The Sleeping Gypsy. A lion guards her dream journal. The gypsy has been writing for many years, a secret text no one will ever read, but which has begun to materialize in real life. While she continues dreaming, her dreams create the world. The lion, however, cannot sleep. If he ceases to watch her, she could awaken and we vanish instantly. Thank you very much.
I would be remiss following that poem to not give you an opportunity to if you have a message for the Trump administration, the administration that's been enacting many policies that have been harming families, separating them, what would your message be?
Well, you know, all the laws to defend the land, to defend the rights of women, to defend the rights of asylum seekers. The U.S. has signed international agreements, and most of the people that are coming from Central America and Mexico are fleeing violence, you know, political violence and economic violence. And so these rights cannot be taken away. And so if you take away the rights of the land, the rights of women, the rights of children, you are going to be remembered forever as the destroyers of what civilization has achieved, not only here in the U.S., but around the world.
And one of the things that the Trump administration is working towards is eliminating domestic violence as a reason to seek asylum in this country. And they've said that they should reserve asylum for more valid reasons. What do you say to that?
The definition of domestic violence is up for grabs, you know. Domestic violence is what the U.S. has been doing to the Americas for more than half a century. You know, it did it to my country. They destroyed my country. They destroyed, previous to that, Guatemala. They have been harming so many people. They're still doing it in Yemen and in all the places where they are supporting authoritarian, violent governments. So what kind of violence are they trying to prevent?
Thank you. Transitioning to your exhibit in Berkeley, tell us what we can expect. I understand that there's going to be the inaugural event to open the exhibit coming up on Wednesday. Tell us what that would be like.
The exhibition is called About to Happen, and it refers to the fact that my art is really not describable. Everything that you say about it may mislead you to think something else. So you really have to experience it. You have to experience the encounter with the basuritas, the little pieces of debris that had been assembled, to invent a new kind of relationship with the objects themselves, with the fact that everything is about to disappear. Everything is constantly disappearing and dying. And so it's an encounter with death, but death interpreted as beauty and transformation, not only as the disappearance of what you love, but the possibility of something new emerging. So there's also a kipu, and I have been doing kipus all my life. And kipu is a form of textile that was created in the Andes 5,000 years ago. It's a form of a script without script, where information is encoded in knots. So I have created some monumental kipus, and I have created a kipu for Berkeley that is called Burnt Kipu. And it refers to the fact that because of global warming, a fire is closing in on us, you know, not just the fire of the forest fires, but the fire of drought, the fire of thirst. Unless we change our ways, we're really headed towards very terrible times.
This is for sure a time that many people are feeling disparaged and they're a little bit low on hope in some cases. Some people are saying that they're finding their voice more now than ever, but there's kind of that tension between those two places. So I'm wondering if you can talk about how you continue to find your place of hope and your place of inspiration in the face of the things that we're facing right now, particularly under the Trump administration. But even though this is one iteration of it, there's been decades and decades and decades of this. So how do you continue to find hope?
I remember how I felt when there was any form of unfairness directed either at me or at my little brother. I couldn't take unfairness, and I think this notion that any human being cannot abide by unfairness, because there's something innate in us that wants justice. I think that is the most beautiful feeling, because all forms of sisterhood, brotherhood, solidarity, empathy come from that innate feeling. And if we remember that and we open up to what we feel when we see, for example, a child taken away from the mother, if we see any form of unfairness to someone because this person looks different, speaks different, feels different, thinks different, we cannot abide by that. We have to follow our heart that responds to a desire of justice, which is not just justice for us. It has to be justice for all. That's the only way it works.
And is that really innate craving for justice? Is that what gives you your continued sense of hope? Or is there anything else that you'd like to expand?
Absolutely. Because, for example, my relationship with poetry comes from the desire to hear what language really says. It's not what we're taught. It's not what we are expected to hear or see in language. I always explore because I think this notion of poetic justice has to be first about the act of listening, to really listening to what life is saying. Life is saying, watch out. The life force is diminishing. Oxygen is going away. You see, we are really hurting life and we are not hearing life itself. And that is to our own peril, to the peril of our species. So I get a lot of inspiration just from being completely quiet, hearing the insects. Insects are being exterminated. If there are no insects, there's going to be no pollinization, no food for us. So everything is related to everything else if we pay attention. It's the art of attention, the one that we have to open up to.
So I have a feeling that your artwork is going to inspire people to think about pausing, about listening more, talking less. What is the main message you hope that viewers or listeners of your art might receive?
My art is all about things that are breaking down, going away, slipping away from us. And there's a beauty when you sense that something is leaving you. And so from this feeling, there is a desire to value the meaning and the significance of being alive just for a short time. And from that comes infinite joy and beauty.
And finally, as an activist, an artist, a woman, a filmmaker, a poet, as somebody who's been in exile for many years, what would you say is the most important lesson that you've learned on your journey so far?
That there's always somebody that is with you, somebody that listens even better than you do, somebody that feels even deeper than you do. And engaging with such people opens you up and enriches you so fully and completely. Join with others, open up to others, because that is the way you open to yourself.
Beautiful. Anything else you'd like to add before we close?
Come see the about to happen and something may happen.
Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you.